Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns, over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And if you don't listen to Island Issues on the radio, it's online as a podcast at lava1053.com and at koacountry1077.com. Just click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. A constant topic of importance and sometimes concern here on Hawaii Island is our active volcanoes. Today we'll get an update on the most active, Kilauea and Mauna Loa. Ancient Hawaiians documented the volcano via oral history, and scientists also have read newspapers from the 1800s to learn more about the more recent history. We today have an outstanding resource here on Hawaii Island with a purpose to watch over, study, and analyze the volcanoes. The United States Geological Survey's Hawaiian Volcano Observatory marks its formal beginning as 1912. Today we'll get an update on our most active volcanoes from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory Chief Scientist, Tina Neal. I'm sitting in Tina Neal's office at HVO today, and today is Thursday, February 23rd. I mention this because new things happen all the time with the volcanoes, especially Kilauea. Good morning. Aloha, Tina.
Aloha. Thank you for coming.
Now, I think the best place to start is with our current most active volcano, Kilauea. It's been erupting continuously since 1983, and in the past several years, we've seen it approach Pahoa Town and then fortunately pull back. Now there's a lot of activity at both Halema'uma'u Crater, which is right outside your office window, and from Pu'uo'o Vent, which is sending lava to the ocean. So just talk about what the current situation is, please.
Sure. Well, Kilauea, our most active volcano, is really steady as she goes, if I had to encapsulate in a short phrase. Here at the summit eruption in Halema'uma'u Crater, we have the lava lake that continues to rise and fall over the course of days, up and down 30 to 60 feet in kind of a range of changing elevation, in concert with these deflation-inflation events that we have at the summit. These are the sort of breathing of the summit magma reservoir, if you will, as it pressurizes and depressurizes with input and outflow of magma. The summit rises and falls, and the lake rises and falls pretty much in concert. So that's been going on steadily now for a number of years. Thankfully, at times the lake has risen high enough that folks right here at the Jagger Overlook inside Hawaii Volcanoes National Park get a great view of the lake and its spattering behavior, such as right now, today. We just looked out the window and saw some great spatter. But there have been times when it's deflated and deepened such that it's out of view. But that behavior has been going on very steadily now for many months, if not years. The last time we had the lake rise high enough to produce a tiny overflow on the floor of Halema'uma'u was in October. Since then, the lake has remained well below the rim. But that could change. There's no reason to suspect that it won't rise high enough again to overflow onto the Halema'uma'u floor. Meanwhile, down in the East Rift Zone, things are also continuing fairly steadily. There have been no major changes at the Pu'uo'o Vent on the East Rift Zone of Kilauea. Lava continues to emit from the east flank of the volcano through a tube system, 11 kilometers or about 7 miles down to the Kamakuna Ocean entry. What has changed in that regard is that, as you know, a lava delta was building at the ocean entry, beginning when it first hit the ocean last July. And then on New Year's Eve, there was a series of collapse events which resulted in the consumption, or I should say the loss, of most of that lava delta as it slid away into the sea. Since then, as folks know from photos and firsthand experience, we've had this marvelous fire hose of lava pouring into the ocean fairly steadily. And what has been unusual in this regard is that no new delta has yet formed. My longtime geologists here tell me that that is unusual for these past collapse and follow-on fire hose events. The only thing we can conclude from that is that it's likely the submarine topography there is extremely steep. It's very deep, immediately offshore, and so there's really no way for lava rubble to accumulate to then support the development of a delta. How long this is going to go on, we're not certain. What we'd love to be able to do is actually map, get some sense of the underwater bathymetry there, because that will help us interpret this process. But that's a little challenging. It's a tricky place to work. It's expensive to bring in boats with mapping technology in their hull or be able to tow a mapping fish. But we're trying to figure out ways to do that. The other changes going on related to the East Rift Zone Pu'ua eruption is that from time to time, the system gets overpressurized. And that typically happens when the summit lava lake is high and the summit is pressurized. You can think of it like an extra voluminous slug of melt going down into the rift zone plumbing system. And sometimes this overpressurizes the lava tube and you'll get breakouts at the surface. And that has happened on and off for the last 6 months out there. For a while, the breakouts were confined to the Pu'uo'o region, and so people really weren't seeing any evidence of this. But just in the last few weeks, we've had breakouts further down the lava tube, and right now there are a number of active surface flows on the Pali, and I understand yesterday one of these is occurring on the east side of the lava flow and just entering the park again down on the Kalapana side. So at this point, I think it's about 700 meters or yards from the ocean. Moving very sluggishly, it's Pohoihoi. But while these surface breakouts are occurring from multiple points, it's probably robbing some of the supply that's feeding that fire hose into the ocean at Kamakuna. And so folks may have noticed that that is a little less visible these days, a little less dramatic than it was a month or two ago. And it's likely because of the surface activity stealing some of that supply. So it remains a dynamic landscape down there. We don't know what will happen. These surface flows are likely to have a short life and then peter out, but it's always possible that one of them will develop into a more major new lava stream and come down adjacent to the current one. So we're watching it, and our geologists are getting out on the ground every week or so, trying to do some aerial observations as often as we can and keep the park and civil defense updated about the changes.
Tina Neal, do you have concerns at this time about the potential for lava again flowing, say, towards Pahoa Town or any inhabited area?
Not at this time. The current tube system and vent system within Pu'uo'o seems pretty well established. There's no sign of instability that we can see. So for the near term, lava should be heading to the south, southeast, towards the ocean and away from inhabited areas. However, as you noted, that can change rapidly. If we have another pressurization event, there might be a breakout on a slightly different part of Pu'uo'o, which could then begin to send lava back to the northeast. So it's always a possibility. But even if it did that, Sherry, it would take a long time for that lava flow to develop into a tube system and then potentially threaten inhabited areas.
When we speak about threatening, as we look outside your office window and we see that lava lake and we see the spattering that you noted, you said that the lava lake goes up and down, and it not very long ago did reach the level where it actually started spreading a little bit onto the, I'll call it the major part of the Halema'uma'u crater. Is there any concern that it might spread high enough to, say, inundate the Jaggar Museum or threaten other inhabited parts of the park?
Yeah, highly unlikely. And for that to happen, of course, the lake would have to rise to the level of Halema'uma'u, fill the entire crater, and then rise another 85 meters to the top rim of Halema'uma'u and then begin to spread out. Even then, it would be on the caldera floor and well below Jaggar Museum or anything like that. So I'm not concerned about that at all.
You know, before we talk about Mauna Loa, I really do want to mention for listeners who've not taken the time to come over here to take a look at this, it is really a spectacular sight. Being able to look at this active volcano and right now to see active lava spattering, which it has been for the last several times that I've come over, it's quite a sight. And you mentioned that today, that you like to go out and wander among the visitors.
It's true. It really never gets old. And I have my back to the window in my office, but I do try to multiple times in the day get up and turn around and look outside and see this amazing volcanic process going on just a little less than a mile away. And for visitors who have the opportunity to come up, it's really an amazing sight. And the Park Service does a marvelous job informing the visitors about what they're seeing and putting displays in the Jaggar Museum.
Okay, Tina Neal, let's turn our attention to Mauna Loa. The first thing I'd like you to do is give us an overview. Mauna Loa is not currently actively erupting, but it is an active volcano. What is Mauna Loa?
Mauna Loa is by many considered to be the largest volcano on the planet. It rises to nearly 14,000 feet above sea level here on the Big Island. And if you add the bulk of the volcano that's below sea level down to the ocean floor, it rises well over 50,000 feet. So it is a massive volcanic landform. In terms of the Big Island, it covers more than half of the surface of the Big Island. And its surface is largely very young. If you were to look at the ages of lava flows that make up Mauna Loa, about 40% of the volcano is covered by lavas less than 1,000 years old. So it's a very actively resurfacing volcano that makes up a large part of the Big Island. The bulk of the two rift zones, the Northeast Rift Zone and the Southwest Rift Zone and the Summit Caldera region, are within Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. A lot of that is wilderness, so very remote and difficult to access. It's a long way away to get to the summit of the volcano. Even though we live on what we think is a fairly smallish island, when I look up at the summit, I realize that that's a long way away. It takes a long time to walk there. And the volcano is just a massive part of our landscape.
When was the last eruption of Mauna Loa volcano?
Mauna Loa last erupted in March and April of 1984, 33 years ago now.
Actually, it's not too far in time from when Kilauea began its current very active and ongoing eruption.
That's true. Whether or not that's a coincidence, I guess, remains to be seen. But the fact that it's been a good long time since Mauna Loa has erupted, and the fact that we've been seeing elevated signs of unrest at Mauna Loa over the past several years, bring us to where we are today, and that is the volcano remains at an elevated level of concern and alert level. It went from green, normal, to yellow advisory in September of 2015, after more than a year of slightly higher levels of background earthquake activity, and also deformation, and by that I mean a swelling of the volcano in its upper elevations in response to magma coming into the summit magma reservoir system and basically filling that, adding volume and pushing on the outer part of the volcano. We remain at this heightened level of concern and alert status because we're continuing to see elevated earthquake activity and deformation activity. I will point out that the rates of earthquake activity and deformation have actually come down a bit from when we made that change in color code and alert status, but they still remain above what we have defined as our long-term background, which is difficult to define precisely, but if you look at the long-term plots of the numbers of earthquakes, particularly earthquakes above 2.5, we're still seeing more in a given week than we were prior to 2013 and 14. In addition, we're still seeing evidence from our GPS stations and other information from satellite that the volcano remains swelling. It's inflating still a little bit as magma is added to that system. So as long as we're seeing that activity at rates that are above the long-term background when it's been a very quiet system, we'll probably stay at yellow.
How do you measure the seismic activity?
We have a number of seismometers deployed on the entire island. If you take the ones we have in Mauna Loa, Kilauea, and the rest of the Big Island, we have almost 60 seismometers. So the island is small enough that you can detect Mauna Loa earthquakes on seismometers that are even off the volcano. But these seismometers operate 24/7. They're constantly listening for the earth to make vibrations related to earthquakes or other fluid movement in the crust. These are the instruments that allow us to detect and locate these earthquakes underneath Mauna Loa volcano.
So if a seismometer indicates there's been an earthquake that you consider significant, let's say it's 2 a.m, how do the scientists find out about it?
Well, we have alarm systems that work on our various data streams, including earthquake data. And if there is an earthquake large enough to exceed a threshold of shaking on a number of stations, we will get a text message. Many of us are on this system. And so we wake up in the middle of the night, look at the data. Our duty seismologist is responsible for getting into it a little more detailed and deciding if it's something significant enough that we need to wake people up and get into the office or not. So this happens on occasion. The alarms are often set off by large earthquakes elsewhere on the planet, because even large earthquakes across the ocean basin will send seismic waves that trigger these alarms. So they're pretty sensitive. Our deformation system, our tilt meters, are also similarly alarmed, so that, for instance, at Kilauea, the Uikahuna tilt meter right across the street here, if it starts to see a very rapid change in summit tilt, either inflation or deflation, we'll also get a text message. That could mean that the lava lake is going up or down very rapidly, which could be an indicator that we're about to see a change. So it's not surprising for a week to go by and we'll get 3 or 4 of these messages at all hours of the day.
Well, I'm glad you're always on duty. You know, you mentioned that the lava in Mauna Loa has been coming and going. You use different words, but mine are coming and going. Is there a relationship between the lava that feeds Mauna Loa and the lava that feeds Kilauea?
Based on geophysical studies and also geochemical studies, looking at the different lavas from Kilauea versus Mauna Loa, they seem distinct. It's likely that they may have a similar source at great depth in terms of the hotspot and the ultimate source of magmas feeding Hawaiian volcanoes, but it's pretty clear that they don't travel very far before they ascend through different parts of the upper mantle and become distinct. So no, there is no direct communication between the two volcanoes that we have been able to discern.
I understand you also monitor gas emissions at the top of Mauna Loa. Talk a little bit about that and how that informs you.
Yes, we have a single station up in the summit caldera of Mauna Loa, and it's measuring temperature, carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, 24/7. And what we are tracking there is, of course, the thermal state of the summit region and the gas emissions, the idea being that if magma were to begin to move closer to the surface, we should see an increase in sulfur dioxide and possibly an increase in temperature at this fumarole site. To date, since this machine has been in place and working, we're not seeing any really significant change that would lead us to be concerned that magma is very shallow below the summit. But again, we would expect to see a departure from the long-term measurements if the system were changing.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. We're talking today with Tina Neal, scientist in charge at Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. We're getting an update on Kilauea and Mauna Loa, our two most active volcanoes. Next Sunday morning, my guest will be Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim. Listen to Island Issues on the radio on Hawaii Island every Sunday at 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM or at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And then the podcast is posted online, lava1053.com and koacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone to hear this and other past Island Issues broadcasts. Let's get back to my conversation with a scientist in charge at Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, Tina Neal. How will you know when and if an eruption from Mauna Loa is imminent? How exactly will you decide that that is a very good possibility?
It's a very good question, something we talk about internally, think about all the time. Before the volcano erupts, we will expect to see many more earthquakes than we're seeing right now. Typically, in a week right now, we're seeing 20-ish earthquakes under the volcano. Before the 75 and 84 eruption, those numbers went way up, I mean, more than 100 per day. So we would likely see a similar ramp up in the numbers of earthquakes, potentially for days, if not weeks or more, before an eruption. The other critical thing we would see is something called seismic tremor. When magma begins to move in the final kilometer to the surface, it starts shaking the ground continuously and producing a phenomenon we call seismic tremor. It's a very distinctive signal. If we were to start to see that on any of our Mauna Loa stations, that would be a pretty strong red flag that an eruption was imminent. Similarly, as I mentioned, we might see a very sudden tilt change with our tilt meters on Mauna Loa that indicate the ground is moving rather rapidly as magma is pushing the surface up on its way to the surface. So there are a number of different ways we think we would be able to see the eruption coming. How much lead time we're going to have remains to be seen. The tremor for both 75 and 84 eruptions at Mauna Loa was, I think, in one case about 30 minutes, the other case about 90 minutes before the eruption. So that lead time could be very short. With the instrumentation we have on the volcano, we are confident that we would see an increase in the number of earthquakes long before then. But that final signal that it's coming might have a very short lead time. And so we're working on systems to be able to recognize that and inform us very quickly. The other question that you might ask is, once we believe an eruption is imminent, how will we detect when it actually breaks the surface of the volcano? If it's in the middle of the night and the weather is bad and there's cloud cover, we may not see anything. To answer that question, again, we're going to rely heavily on our instrumentation and our ability to localize in three dimensions exactly where the main energy of this eruption beginning is happening. We're also trying to employ some new technologies such as infrasound. Basically, it's sound waves that pass through the air and can be detected rapidly, and then we can use triangulation to point back towards the source of that sound. We have some novel new satellite techniques. Satellites are orbiting the Earth all the time, as you know, and we have some satellites that make a pass over every 15 minutes. Those data are alarmed such that if they see a sudden temperature increase over Mauna Loa, we will get a text message. So that's another technique we're going to be using to rapidly detect an eruption up there. A second important question that will happen as soon as an eruption were to begin is, where is it and which way is the lava going? Because you can imagine from a civil defense perspective, that's what they're going to want to know right away. Which sector of the volcano is most at risk immediately? So that will be one of our big challenges, is to pinpoint where lava is coming out of the ground and then try to decide which way it's flowing.
You mentioned satellites. Are these satellites that are part of the United States Geological Service, or are they NASA satellites that are looking at the volcanoes?
They're not USGS satellites. They're mostly NOAA satellites, some NASA satellites, a whole host of other agencies.
Which I guess speaks to the importance of maintaining the funding for that kind of scientific work. Certainly here on Hawaii Island, that's a major impact for us. It's not just theoretical. It's important to us to understand what these volcanoes are doing.
Absolutely.
I know that, generally speaking, Hawaiian Volcano Observatory is responsible for looking at and monitoring the volcanoes, and then typically you would work with Hawaii County Civil Defense on what to tell the public and when to tell the public. Do you have any sense as to how far in advance the public might be advised that an eruption might be imminent?
Well, it's very hard to give an exact answer to that question. Based on the 74 and 84 experience, we could have lead time as short as a few hours. We hope with our modern monitoring network, we would see in the days to weeks before that a ramp up in activity that would allow us to give people sort of heads up pre-warning, if you will. And that would be a time where obviously all the responding agencies would get together and make sure all our ducks were in a row.
Tina, I've heard Hawaiian Volcano Observatory scientist Frank Truesdale say that all eruptions of Mauna Loa begin at the summit. But then the question comes, does it stay at the summit or does it move into a rift zone? And I know you talked about the challenge of figuring out what might happen next, but is there a way you can know in advance where it's going to go?
You're correct. All of the historical eruptions, so since the early 1800s, have started in the summit region of Mauna Loa, and then some have moved into one of the two rift zones. The best indicator that the site of eruption will be moving into one of the two rift zones, or in a rare case, into some of the radial vent regions on the west flank of the volcano, that's a rarer case historically, but another one we must consider, will again be to track where the earthquakes are happening. Because if a dike of magma is propagating into the rift zone or into the west flank, it should be tracked by earthquakes. So our seismic network should be seeing the spatial pattern, both in depth and XY, where those earthquakes are moving, and that will be a hint to us that the locus of eruption might be changing. It's not a guarantee, because sometimes you can have injections of magma into the rift zones or other parts of the volcano that just don't make it to the surface. But if during an ongoing eruption we see one of these dike-like signals start to propagate in a different direction, that'll be a big red flag that we need to be ready for a new outbreak.
Tina, I've had previous conversations with Jim Kawahikawa and Frank Truesdale about some of the Mauna Loa eruptions, and our experience here in the last 30-plus years is looking at Kilauea, where the eruptions are, in general, fairly non-threatening. They move fairly slowly, and you scientists have been able to do a fabulous job of telling the public what's going to happen, working closely with Hawaii County Civil Defense. But Mauna Loa, I know, had at least one eruption that I believe in 1950 went from the top of Mauna Loa to the South Kona coast in 3 hours. And just now, as we were walking into your office, we saw a map of Mauna Loa eruptions, which showed that many of the eruptions that ended up on the west side of Hawaii Island reached the coast in not just 3 hours, 14, less than 24, 4 hours. I mean, that's a far more daunting situation than Kilauea seems to present today. So talk about that aspect. Tell me more about Mauna Loa and what the potential is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've described it very well. The historic experience with Mauna Loa is that it has had eruptions that have sent lavas to the coast from the upper rift zones in just hours. If you live on the west side of the volcano, that does pose a concern because the topography there is very steep. There's just one road that gets you in and out. And if that were to occur, it's possible the highway could be cut in multiple places. So there are some real risks with that scenario. And that's one reason we're working really hard to be able to localize the point of eruption and be able to tell which way lavas are going very quickly. We will be in further dialogue with Civil Defense about how we're going to make that work in real time, because as you correctly point out, it's our job to detect what's happening on the volcano, interpret it, and pass information to Civil Defense and other authorities who make decisions about people on the ground. But you're also right to contrast Mauna Loa and Kilauea. Typically, Mauna Loa eruptions that we've seen historically will produce quite a bit more lava in the same amount of time as Kilauea, up to 100 times more lava per hour per day than Kilauea has produced. So these lava flows can be very voluminous and very fast moving compared to what we saw, say, a threatening Pahoa in 2014. Other challenges that Mauna Loa presents that are unlike Kilauea, as you say, the impacts can be quite far-reaching. In addition to threatening people who live in the immediate downstream area, if the Highway 11 were to be cut, that would impact the entire island in terms of commuting, in terms of potential infrastructure. So the impacts are quite far-reaching for any kind of Mauna Loa eruption. We also would anticipate a very large and far-ranging cloud of volcanic gas. The VOG problem would be even more exacerbated should we have a voluminous Mauna Loa eruption. So there certainly are some bigger challenges that a Mauna Loa eruption will present.
When you talk about the gas impact, when there have been some volcanic eruptions elsewhere, air traffic has been interrupted. Would that be a likely or a potential consequence of a Mauna Loa eruption?
It's possible. In other parts of the world, the main threat to aircraft is airborne ash, solid particulate matter, which would be much less of an issue here. The high fountaining up near the summit of Mauna Loa would produce some fine basaltic ash, but not likely enough to interfere with air traffic. However, the fog cloud, depending on where it went with respect to the Kona airport, could present a hazard to some air traffic, and airlines may choose not to fly. That's a situation we haven't really encountered here, because in 1984, there was quite a bit less air traffic.
Mauna Loa is mostly, and certainly the summit is, within Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Civil defense has a huge role if there's an eruption. How are the scientists, the park, civil defense, other first responders working together to prepare for, I would have to say, when Mauna Loa erupts, even though it would be perhaps more correct to say if and when, but basically based on history, I'd have to say when.
Yes, absolutely. It will erupt again. And it's critically important that all the different agencies that have a part in a response and the preparedness side work together to prepare a coordinated approach to that. We have done a few things and will continue to do a number of things. In the late 2015, soon after we elevated the alert level, we had a tabletop exercise with Park Service and civil defense representatives. It was an almost all-day affair where we kind of walked through a scenario of a Mauna Loa eruption. This gave everybody a chance to think about what our internal response actions would be, where some of the coordination challenges are going to be. We need to do that again. I'd like to do another tabletop. Now that we have a new civil defense chief under Mayor Kim's administration, we'll revisit that sometime soon. There are additional conversations that we're having with the National Park Service informally about how we will work together in terms of response, particularly with regard to aviation. Mauna Loa is big enough and far enough away that we will need helicopter assets to do our job. And depending on where the eruption is happening, it's likely Park Service will also have an aviation response, and so we need to work together to make it efficient and safe. Similarly, civil defense will be involved. So there are a number of facets of pre-planning that we're trying to address now. Janet Babb, our outreach geologist, is beginning something that we call a communication plan, which should be near and dear to your heart, in that we're going to be thinking about how are we going to release information in a coherent and helpful fashion as expeditiously as we can during a crisis so that the public and everyone else who needs to know gets the information they need. In this age of internet communication, that's much more challenging. Everything's 24/7. Every deadline is immediate. And so we need to have our ducks in a row ahead of time to be able to get information out responsibly, but as quickly as possible. So Janet's putting some thought into that with others, and that's great.
Well, it is great, and I think during the Pahoa lava flow, certainly you scientists at Hawaiian Volcano Observatory did a great job, and Daryl Oliveira, the civil defense chief at the time, did a fabulous job. And I would just like to say that I really think the issues on communication are fine when you're talking about journalists here in Hawaii, but these eruptions tend to bring in people from all over the world who have this huge desire to be the first with the story. And you'll also have scientists coming in from all over the world.
You're absolutely right, and that's another part of our pre-planning discussion. A Mauna Loa eruption will be a science magnet for volcanologists from all over the world who want to come and do some very good research and assist in aspects of the response that we'll need. The USGS can't do everything. So we are trying to put some thought into how to coordinate that. That'll be a challenge for Civil Defense and Park Service because they will have some control over access to the active lava flows, but they will probably look to us to help vet and decide which science is most important and who can work safely. Again, there's not an intent to close the area to scientists, but there does have to be some active management to make sure it's both safe and effective. We have a colleague at the University of Hawaii in Manoa, Dr. Scott Rowland, volcanologist, who has tried over the years to think through this whole broader scientific response to a Mauna Loa eruption, and there are some things in place to help us navigate that. In preparation for a Mauna Loa eruption, thinking about planning, we have thought about what help we would need here at HVO, because our staff is small, we'll be overstretched pretty quickly. There are some U.S. Geological Survey geologists on the mainland at other observatories, some who are alumna of HVO who would be first on the list to come over and help, and I've informed them all to keep their bags packed and ready. So that's great, and we will also likely have some academic colleagues who will be able to play a role in helping us with our response. So we are trying to develop that bench, if you will.
Well, I think that's good. I'm curious, how many people here on staff at USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory?
I think the current number is 26. Actually, very exciting. We've had two new hires in the last 6 months. Really happy we've been able to add a few people, mostly replacing retirements and others who've moved on. We had a retirement just a few months ago. Our lead gas chemist retired, and so I hope we'll be able to replace that position here in the coming year because that's a very critical position at HVO, given that particularly the Kilauea summit eruption is essentially a gas eruption at this time.
Well, in fact, I have an interview coming up with Tamara Elias, who is a gas geochemist here, and that's exactly what we'll be talking about is fog. But that's good that you are planning to bring in more folks, because I know that during the Pahoa lava flow, I mean, I witnessed how hard you guys worked. You were working 24/7, and you were doing a lot of community updates. So I know that that's really important. We want to feel that you're going to be able to address the issues when they arise, because Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, you are the link to what's happening with our volcanoes. So I'm delighted that you're planning. Tina Neal, last time you and I spoke formally for Island Issues was about 9 months ago. And I'm curious to know, in the last 9 months, have you learned anything new from previous eruptions and the studies you've been doing that are informing your guesses as to what might happen for future eruptions for really either Mauna Loa or Kilauea?
It isn't entirely a new insight, but our ongoing deformation monitoring on Mauna Loa, primarily with GPS instruments, but also with satellite-based radar, has shown this remarkable dynamic change in how the volcano is deforming during this period of unrest. Our geophysicist Ingrid Johansson gave a talk during Volcano Awareness Month on this and showed some animations of a visualization of the changing magma storage, if you will, inside Mauna Loa volcano. So she's taken this deformation data since the beginning of the unrest and basically created a model or a modeled way of showing visually how the volcano is storing and accumulating magma in different places at different times. While we may not have learned anything new from this, it has really given us a powerful new way of understanding the changes happening at the volcano. So this is not necessarily a new technique, but it's a new way of looking at these particular data. Another thing I'll mention is that Don Swanson, who is much in the mold of Thomas Jagger, the geologist who goes down to the lava lake almost every day and makes observations and collects ash and other material that's been ejected from the lake overnight, he's been doing some very careful measurements of the amount and the type of solid material fragments collected every morning. And he's seeing some very interesting patterns through time. This is all unpublished and unreviewed data and interpretations yet, but I think he's on to some really interesting insights about the magma supply to the summit of the volcano here at Kilauea and what that might be telling us in terms of the long-term behavior of magma ascending into this volcano. Eventually, whatever he derives from these observations could tell us something fundamental about how the volcano behaves over the long term, and that could inform our ability to forecast what's going to happen next.
Tina Neal, before we say aloha, what have I not asked you that would be important for the public to know?
I think I want to return to the ocean entry just to underscore the message that we've been putting out and others have been putting out since lava again hit the sea last summer. It's a spectacular sight, and it's wonderful that the Park Service and Civil Defense are allowing people to walk in from either side on the emergency access road to a safe distance to observe. I do want to emphasize that there are still hazards that people need to be aware of when you're out there. And those continue to be the instability of the sea cliff around the ocean entry. As we saw just a few weeks ago, even parts of the older sea cliff are unstable in places and can collapse without warning. So that's one reason the Park Service rope line is so far back. That will continue as long as the activity continues. The other issue is that that white plume that's generated where lava reaches the ocean creates this rather noxious mixture of volcanic glass, hydrochloric acid, and superheated steam, and it itself is dangerous. And so people really need to avoid being in that plume. Our folks, when we go down there, avoid that plume, and we always have hard hats and gas masks with us. In terms of the offshore hazards, I know there are some wonderful tour boat opportunities that people are taking advantage of. There are hazards to the boats if they get too close, not just from this potential collapse that we've discussed, but the water that's right around the entry zone is quite hot. Our thermal cameras have shown temperatures, I believe, in the range of 150, 160 degrees Fahrenheit, so certainly scalding. When these collapses occur, there can be wave action just offshore that can be enough to swamp boats, so we hope that boats are keeping a safe distance. So again, just to underscore that while it's an absolutely magnificent process to see, and I hope folks all have a chance to do it, there are real hazards, and I'd like to encourage people to obey the warning signs.
One final thing about Mauna Loa, is an eruption imminent?
No, Mauna Loa is restless, but there is no imminent eruption.
Thank you so much, Tina Neal, Chief Scientist at Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. Aloha.
Aloha, and thank you for coming.
And to our listeners, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Sherry Bracken. This is Island Issues. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us, info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.